Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor, and this month I'm pleased to be able to present another story by one of EQMM's most accomplished short story writers, Tim L. Williams. A college professor whose work has appeared in literary as well as crime fiction magazines, Tim Williams has been honored with 2 Seamus Award nominations, an Edgar Allan Poe Award nomination, and 2 International Thriller Awards for his short stories. Here he is reading his 2014 Thriller Award winner, The Last Wrestling Bear in West Kentucky, a story that originally appeared in the September-October 2014 EQMM and has since been reprinted in the collection of his stories entitled Skull Fragments.
This is where I am, sitting at a table in Redheaded Ray's Roadhouse, 5 miles outside of Greenview, Kentucky, listening to my ex-convict son talk about the future while we wait for the wrestling bear. Danny is 22, an optimist, even though he spent the last 17 months at Roto-Rooter Correctional, and has now landed back in Harps County with no girlfriend, no job, and no real hope of landing either of them in the foreseeable future. Still, he believes finding the wrestling bear is an omen, a sign better times are coming. Me, I don't see the connection. He strips the label from his bottle of Bud and grins at me. Okay, listen, he says. I've been talking about heading to Montana or Wyoming for years, and they got bears out there, right? A week after I come home, we run across this one? He drops the strip label in an ashtray, leans back in his chair, and folds his hands behind his head. You tell me, he says. There's no point in telling him that Redheaded Ray's is a place people come to drink, fight, maybe pick up a late-night companion, not to look for omens. Lynyrd Skynyrd plays over and over on an old jukebox. The shelf behind the bar is lined with jars of pickled pig's feet, circa 1975. There are flyers that advertise a Wednesday night line dance and a Saturday night wet t-shirt contest. A banner on the far wall says, Welcome to Redheaded Ray's, home of Elmore the Wrestling Bear. It's 6:30 on a Saturday, still hot and bright outside, but the bar is blissfully dark and mortuary cool. Beer-bellied farmers, out-of-work miners, a few would-be outlaws, and hard-eyed women wearing too much makeup and short skirts that show the white, puckered skin on their thighs, shoot pool in the back room or share pitchers at the tables, or stand too deep at the bar. A couple of women look our way, glance at the dance floor, smile at Danny. When he left for prison, he was a tall, gawky kid with chronic acne and a facial tic from years of snorting crystal meth. Now he's thick and healthy. With his crew cut, his clear blue eyes, his broad shoulders and defined biceps, he looks more like a Marine home on furlough than a lawnmower thief out on parole. I say, you really want to wrestle a bear? He says he always had a thing for bears, used to collect stuffed ones, pestered his mom to take him to Yellowstone for summer vacation when he was a little kid. He lights a cigarette, grins at me through the smoke, his eyes crinkled, his lips spread tight. The same smirk his mother used to give when she beat me in a game of hearts. You probably wouldn't remember that, would you, he says. By the late 90s, most of the coal mines in this part of West Kentucky packed up their operations and lit out for shallower veins and union-free labor, leaving behind thousands of acres of useless land and a few rusting shovels to remind us of better times. I figured what was good enough for Peabody was good enough for me, so I loaded my life in the back of a pickup and left behind a soon-to-be ex-wife and a 5-year-old son. For the next 15 years, I worked the oil fields in Texas and Oklahoma and Louisiana, but things went sour down there, too. After I lost my job and my girlfriend and got busted for a DUI in Shreveport, I decided it was time to see Kentucky again. Now I work at an ideal station, pumping gas, checking oil, wiping windshields for a nickel better than minimum wage. When I first came back to town, Danny and I bumped up against each other at Walmart in the 8-Ball Lounge. The first few weeks he'd just glare at me, the muscles in his jaw working and his lips twisted into what he probably believed was a tough guy sneer. He seemed trying to work himself up to something, but I got tired of waiting. Finally, one night at the 8-Ball, I told him we had a choice. We could step outside or we could have a drink. He held my eyes for a minute, as if he were debating it, but then flipped his greasy bangs from his eyes and said, What the hell? Yesterday was long gone anyway. After that, we shot pool a couple of times, shared a few pictures. Then he went to prison and I wrote him a few letters. Now, this is what I know about my son. He got hooked on meth during his senior year in high school. He was desperate and foolish enough to believe that he could make a killing stealing lawnmowers from Rural King. He drinks Jack Daniels and Budweiser. He believes his good luck will start tomorrow. And tonight, he wants to wrestle a bear. A waitress in cut-off shorts and a Laid in America t-shirt brings us another round and makes sure to brush her breast against Danny when she reaches to empty our ashtray. I give her what used to be an irresistible smile, but she ignores me, rests her hand on Danny's shoulder. You need anything, you just whistle, sweetie, she tells him. Anything at all you want, I'll be right here. He pats her hand, pitches a tin on her tray, tells her to keep the change. His mother, recently married for the fourth time and living in Lexington with her geography teacher husband, sent him $500 to help him get back on his feet. Danny calls it fresh start money, but he's already pissing it away on beer and whiskey. Now I tell him that he's made a conquest, and yeah, maybe the waitress is a little on the chubby side, and her acne isn't exactly attractive, but I'd rather go three rounds with her than a bear. He grins and stares into the neck of his bottle and peels another label. His mother, Cheryl, used to have the same habit. I was always finding strips of something on our coffee table or in the ashtray of our car. You look just like your mother, I say. She swears I look like you. I heard about it every day in my life until I got away from her. I try to make a joke of it. Hey, I say, I'm the one who ought to be ticked off. You aren't half as good looking as I was when I was your age. These are the things Danny and I do not talk about. Our past, my marriage to his mother, what I did on the road, how he lived when he was strung out on meth, what happened to him in prison. This is what we can talk about. Beer, basketball, women, the future, and bears. I say, I tell you what, if it's a little bear, I might go a couple of rounds with him myself. Danny smiles, but there's no kindness in it. Old man, he says, you better hope it's a cub. There are three rules for wrestling the bear. No gouging in the eyes, no kicking in the nuts, no biting the bear. Red-headed Ray McAllen, owner of both Bar and Bear, stands at our table with a foot propped on an empty chair and explains all this between puffs on a Swisher Sweet cigar. Danny nods his agreement, and I remember him at three, sitting on his mother's lap, eyes wide, listening to my jumbled version of fairy tales. $50 up front. You last three full rounds with Elmore, you triple your money. He jabs his cigar in Danny's direction. Three full rounds. No excuses, no explanation. You understand? Danny hands him the cash and then asks questions about the bear. Is it black or brown? Was it born in the wild? How did they train it to wrestle? When can he get a look at the bear? McAllen grunts and flicks ash from the toe of his boot with a long, yellowed fingernail. You ask a lot of questions. You think you're Jerry Friggin Springer? No, Danny says, I don't think that. McAllen snorts and squints through the cloud of smoke between them. You sure about that? The way you've been flapping your gums, I thought maybe you had the delusion that I give a shit about what you got to say. Danny straightens in his chair, lifts his head, holds the older man's stare. His muscles are tensed, his eyes glimmering, and his grin is tight and cold. The kind of grin that a man with a gun to your head might give just before his finger tightens on the trigger. It hits me, then, that the man sitting across from me has nothing in common with the little boy I left or the strung-out, terrified kid they sent away to prison. McAllen is a large man, infamous around Harps County for the shortness of his temper and his fondness for sending troublemaking drunks to the ER in the back of an ambulance. But something in Danny's expression spooks him. I can see it in the twitch of his finger, the nervous blinking of his gray eyes. I was just yanking your chain, buddy, he winks at me. Kids these days, they take things too serious. He snubs his cigar and pulls out a couple of sheets of wrinkled paper from the back pocket of his Levi's. You'll be fifth on the list to wrestle, so I figure you'll be on at 8 or 8:30 at the latest, and you'll need to sign this waiver here. It's the standard lawyer cover your butt document saying that you won't hold us responsible for any injuries sustained. After the papers are signed, McAllen wishes Danny good luck and saunters back towards the bar. Danny watches him, eyes hard, sneering a little. Yard bitch, he says. I know his kind. I nod and close my eyes. I can see the future coming at us like an 18-wheeler. The jukebox repeats itself. Lynyrd Skynyrd, Hank Jr., Waylon and Willie, Lynyrd Skynyrd again. McAllen is perched on a bar stool talking with his cronies, but ever so often his eyes move in our direction, but Danny isn't paying him any attention. He orders a new pitcher of beer and a couple of shots of whiskey, chain smokes, drums his hands on the table. It's well past 7, but there's no sign of the bear, and Danny's restless, talking too fast and endlessly about his plans for the future. He figures he'll end up heading west, maybe go to work on a ranch in Montana, or maybe hook up with a buddy of his who has a fly fishing business out in Wyoming. He makes it sound as if his only problem is deciding whether he wants to be Roy Rogers on the open range or the Bill Gates of trout lures. I nod and say, uh-huh, or okay, when it looks as if he expects a reaction, but he doesn't notice. That's okay, though. The more he babbles about things that are never going to happen, the easier it is for me to forget about the full-grown, dangerous man who looked as if he might snap Ray McAllen in half with his bare hands, and hold on to the freckled, sad-eyed little boy I want to remember. Then a girl walks through the door. She's thin but not frail, 19 or 20 maybe, striking with her baggy jeans and black halter and sneakers in a room filled with miniskirts, frilled blouses, and high-heeled boots. She stands in the doorway, hands on her hips, scowling like a kindergarten teacher observing a group of unruly 5-year-olds. Then she tucks a strand of her long dishwater blonde hair behind her ear, hitches her jeans, and moves to the bar. She doesn't belong in here, Danny says. I want to say that we don't either, but that would be a lie, so I just shrug and watch the girl as she steps close to a thin man in cowboy boots and a John Deere cap and taps him on the shoulder. He swivels on his stool, nudges the guy sitting next to him. Both of them look her over, but then the skinny guy says something to his buddy. They laugh and then turn back to the bar. The girl taps him on the shoulder again, holds her thumb and index finger an inch apart, and says something that makes the guy pop off his stool. Danny pushes back his chair, makes as if to stand. Leave it alone, I say. She's just hustling drinks. He gives me a look, partly pity and partly disapproval. By the time he pushes his way through the crowd, Ray McAllen has the girl by the elbow and is yanking her towards the door. Danny steps in front of them, says something that makes McAllen shake his head. Danny takes a step closer, and the skinny guy swivels on his bar stool as if he means to get involved. But a quick flick of Danny's eyes changes his mind. Then Danny reaches for the girl's hand, and McAllen lets her go, like a reluctant father surrendering a daughter to the groom. When they reach our table, she grins at me and sits in Danny's chair, elbows propped in front of her, stringy hair falling into her eyes. Her jeans are filthy with mud and grass stains, her halter so threadbare that it looks as if she's wrapped her breast in black gauze. I look longer than I should, and Danny frowns, scoots a chair closer to her, as if she might need protection. Hey, she says, is Galahad here really going to wrestle a bear? I say, so I've been told, and she says, that's really weird. She fills Danny's mug and licks foam from the rim before she takes a drink. Her name is Tennessee. Well, not really, but that's what she's going by now, because it has personality, unlike her real name, Lottie. Lottie, she says, is the kind of name you'd give to an unwanted dog. Besides, she says, she met some really nice people in Tennessee, which is nothing like Texas, where the people are supposed to be friendly but aren't, and where she'd been robbed outside of Dallas by a guy who was old enough to be her grandfather. Weird, she says, refilling her mug. I mean, he had to be like 60 or something. She shrugs and wipes her mouth on the back of her hand. Hey, she asks, has anyone ever said you guys look alike? Danny says he always thought he was better looking than his old man, and Tennessee touches my hand and smiles. She says it's real sweet that we're drinking together. I can't imagine drinking with my dad. He's a Baptist preacher back in Missouri, which is where I'm originally from, in case I haven't mentioned it. I mean, my dad's all right, she says, but he doesn't have much of a sense of humor. She says in the end, that's why she dropped out of East Missouri Community College and hit the road. Well, that and this bad breakup with a guy who turned out to be a stalker. Since then, she's been to 11 states. Kansas was the weirdest, but Kentucky's pretty close. Danny lifts a strand of her greasy hair from her shoulder and runs it between his thumb and finger as if it's precious silk, and she beams a smile up at him. Young love, I think, and thinking that makes me feel sour. Maybe because I'm not in love, and it's been a long, long time since anyone called me young. When the opening chords of Desperado start on the jukebox, Tennessee drains the last of the beer and says, "So what do you do in Kentucky besides drink and rescue damsels in distress and wrestle bears?" I give Danny a look and say, "We dance." Her hand feels small and sweaty in mine. Danny's watching us, not smiling, not glaring, just watching. I guess he's thinking I shouldn't be dancing with this girl before he even had a chance to ask. Maybe I should feel guilty about that, but I don't. Instead, I pull her close and breathe in the smell of cigarettes and sweat in her hair and enjoy the feel of her breast pushing against me. When I push back, she whispers in my ear that she ran out of money in Springfield, Tennessee. "You like me, don't you?" I say, "Sure I do." Then she nips my earlobe and says she can take care of me for $40, 60 if I got a condom and want to go all the way. I touch her hair the way Danny did, but it doesn't feel like silk to me. It doesn't feel like anything other than hair that needs a shampoo. I say, "You're beautiful." She steps back and looks at me, chin tucked, her expression so solemn that I nearly laugh. "Are you making fun of me?" she asks. "No." She nods and then smiles. "Cool," she says. "You can think it over." Back at the table, she sits close to Danny and says she's danced up a thirst. He fills a clean mug from a fresh pitcher and reaches for his cigarettes. "You were impressive out there, Pop," he says, making the word pop sound like a profanity. "You got the moves of a three-legged dog." I say, "Why don't you give it a try, Fred Astaire?" "Careful," he says, "you're showing your age." He squeezes Tennessee's shoulder, but doesn't take his eyes from mine. He doesn't know any dancers from this century. She says, "I turned 21 yesterday." She lifts her mug. "Happy birthday to me," she says. When Danny asks if anyone gave her a birthday kiss, she says no one that matters and leans in. When they pull away from each other, she stares into his face, traces his eyebrows with her fingertips. "You have gentle eyes," she says. Then Danny starts talking. He tells a story about his scheme to get rich stealing self-propelled lawnmowers from Rural King and how he was loading one into the back of a truck when an Owensboro cop flashed a light on him, spit a wad of Copenhagen at his shoes, and told him the bad news was that he was under arrest. The good, that he wasn't likely to give himself a hernia in the Davis County Jail. Then he talks about Rotary Correctional, how it doesn't look so bad from the outside, but how looks don't matter. Tennessee says, "Weren't you scared?" I wait for the inevitable tough guy line, "Not me, baby," or "You just have to know how to look out for yourself," something he's heard in a movie and thinks sounds impressive. But Danny runs his hands over the bristles of his crew cut and then looks down at the water rings on the table and says that he was terrified, that it was 2 months before he could sleep through the night. After a while, you get so tired of being scared that you're like a frayed wire, ready to spark at any moment. He sighs and says, "I did a lot up there that I ain't proud of." He cuts his eyes at me, and not what you think or what they always show about a young guy locked up for the first time. He lights his cigarette, and I notice his hands are shaking. The scary thing is you get to like it, get so you believe that being mean proves you aren't scared. I've seen long-term cons, guys who'd been in 15 or 20 years, and they were all like that. You look at them, and they seem calm, easygoing, tranquil even, but they're like copperheads in autumn, you know? The way you see one lying in a pile of leaves and think it's just a stick. You get too close and you find out different, but by then, you're already snake bit. That's the way people get in places like that. I guess I did too. "Hey," she says, "you're sweet, man. I can feel goodness seeping off you." "No," Danny says, "I'm not a good guy, not really. But all that's over, you know? Tonight begins a new day." He tells her about the bear being an omen, a sign that he should get out of Kentucky, head west where the air is clean and cold and a man can make his fortune if he's got brains and guts. I point out that he doesn't know anything about anywhere but Kentucky, that the west he's talking about never existed anywhere other than old black and white movies, and that one place is pretty much the same as any other, but I know neither of them believes it. Then Danny takes my shot of whiskey, downs it, slams the glass down on the table and says, "Bring on the bear!" "He's a little strange when it comes to bears," I say. Danny says even if old Elmore pitches him across the room, it will be worth it because it will be something he's done that not many have, and he believes it's important to do things that other people don't do. That, he says, is what separates you from the herd, makes you an individual. Then it's as if he suddenly realized that he's speaking aloud and gives an embarrassed shrug. "You probably think wrestling a bear is stupid, huh?" he asks. "Weird," she says, "but not stupid." Danny stands and kisses the top of her head. tells us he'll be right back, and then shoves and slides and sidesteps his way towards the men's room. Tennessee watches him, smiling a little to herself. He's nice. You did a good job raising him, she says. I didn't raise him. I left when he was 5 years old. She tucks her bottom lip between her teeth as if considering that, and shrugs. No offense, she says, but maybe you did a good thing by leaving. I turn my mug upside down on the table. I say, you still want to make $40? In the cab of my truck, I lean against the window and watch cars pull into the parking lot and remember high school dates at the Oak Lake Drive-In, nights when Cheryl, 6 months and a missed period away from becoming my wife, would place her head in my lap and make me promise that I would never tell anyone about this, ever. Now I stroke Tennessee's hair, but it just feels greasy beneath my hand, so I close my eyes and catalog all the women I've known who have done this for love or lust or any reason other than a couple of wrinkled $20 bills. Then it's over, and Tennessee wipes her mouth, pockets my money, and steps out of the truck. A couple of young guys sitting on the hood of a Monte Carlo have been watching, and she raises her hand in a wave. When I zip up and climb out of the pickup, one of them gives me a thumbs-up sign and cackles. Danny isn't laughing. When we get back to the table, he has a fresh pitcher of beer and a couple of shot glasses, one empty, the other filled to the brim. There's still no sign of Elmore, but Danny looks as if he's already gone 10 rounds with a grizzly. His head is hung, his eyes narrowed, his shoulders slumped and tense at the same time. Tennessee grabs the shot, knocks it down, and then scrubs at her lips with the back of her hand. Danny barely glances in her direction. Did you two slip outside to do some more dancing? He asks. Then his hand explodes up, connects with my cheek, his elbow sending the ashtray shattering to the floor. It's a slap, not a punch, but it's hard enough to wring my ears and water my eyes. While I'm still trying to blink them clear, he lunges across the table and grips me by the throat. I flail and kick my heels on the floor, but his hand tightens, and there's nothing I can do to break free. He's stronger than I am, stronger than I ever was. He squeezes a little harder, cutting off my wind, but then opens his fingers, leaving me gasping, and I know this was just a warning, a way of letting me know that he could kill me if he wanted, and all I could do was sputter my way to Jesus. Oh, wow, hey, Tennessee says. She smiles at Danny, brushes his cheek with her fingertips. I'm sorry, she says. Danny's hands are shaking. He blinks tears from his eyes, but then takes a quick breath and stiffens his jaw. He looks as if he's about to say something, but then he just shakes his head. That's all right, I say, although I'm not sure why. It's okay. Tennessee takes his hand and makes him look into her eye. I'm going to go now. I mean, I've got to keep traveling, okay? He lifts her finger to his lips and kisses them. It's odd, like something you'd see in an old movie, and I'm proud of him. Then she calls him Galahad again. Take care of each other, she says. Good luck with the bear. She pushes her way through the crowd and out the door. I tell myself that she'll be okay, that girls like Tennessee always turn out all right, but I don't know if it's true. Anything could happen to her. She might be killed and tossed into a drainage ditch, or might find herself in a place like this 10 years from now, when she's too tired to keep running. Or she might go home, marry a car salesman or a banker, have babies, forget that places like Redheaded Ray's ever existed. How can you read someone else's future when you can't, or don't want, to decipher your own? Danny pours us fresh beers. Then Sweet Home Alabama begins on the jukebox yet another time, and while the couples are still dancing, Ray McAllen rushes them off the floor to make room for a makeshift wrestling ring. Danny pulls a 10 from his wallet and throws it on the table. To hell with the bear, he says. I want to go home. The sun is a small, thin sliver of fading orange when Danny walks past my truck and stands at the edge of the road, frowning. He looks one way and then the other, and when he turns around, he seems as disappointed as a kid who woke on Christmas morning to find Santa Claus didn't come. I know he was expecting Tennessee to be waiting. Listen, I say, I offered her $40. She needed the money is all. He studies my face for a moment and then smiles. I want to see the bear. He walks to the back of the roadhouse, shoulders squared, boots crunching off the gravel. I glance at the road one last time and then hurry to catch up with him. The bear is not in a cage or a pen. It's chained to a withered oak tree in a patch of weeds that has been worn down from its constant pacing. For a second, I'm not sure that it's really a bear. It looks more like a large, mangy black dog that's been trained to stand on its hind legs and give a performance. Jesus Christ, Annie says. I don't know a lot about bears, but I do know that Elmore is miles away from the fierce ones I've seen on television and in movies. It's a small black bear about the size of a St. Bernard. When we approach, it growls and then whimpers and tries to shrink behind the oak tree. Feces and mud cake its graying haunches, and there are bald spots and open sores on its back and legs. Once it realizes there's no place to hide from us, it lies in the weeds and whimpers. Danny kicks away an empty food bowl and steps toward the bear, his hand out, palm down to show he's friendly. He calls the bear by its name. Elmore, he says, you're all right. Elmore, you're a handsome bear. Elmore rears, flashes his teeth, but then drops back down when Danny comes closer. I tell him to be careful. Even a little bear can be dangerous, but Danny ignores me. He lets the bear sniff his hand and then reaches to pat the top of its head. This ain't right, he says. That bastard ought to chain him out here all day, see how he likes it. It seems like something you'd say when you're angry, the kind of thing that no one is meant to take seriously, but I can tell from the set of Danny's jaw and the flare of his nostrils that he means it. I say it's a hell of a way to treat a bear, all right. No, he says, it's more than that. An idea occurs to me, and I hope it's good enough to get us out of here and into my truck. We'll call the Humane Society. They'll have that bear out of here and into a sanctuary in no time. Danny looks at me as if I've lost my mind. Screw that, he says. Bears ought to be free in the wild, not locked up in a damn petting zoo. Danny, I say. No, he says. You keep a toolbox in your truck, don't you? We're taking Elmore with us when we go. For a moment, I clutch at the idea that he's joking, but I can't hold on to that for long, not when Danny's already tugging at the rusted lock to test its sturdiness. You're serious? I ask. He looks up at me, and I know exactly what he's thinking. He's thinking, okay, Pop, are you going to come through this one time, or are you going to let me down again? And of course I'm going to disappoint him. Taking the bear is crazy. People don't do things like that. And even if they do, I'm not one of them. Besides, I'm not sure what the penalty is for stealing bears, but I'm pretty sure there must be one. Look, son, I say, and realize that it's the first time in a long time I've called him that. Help or don't, he says. Either way, I'm taking this damn bear. I say, I'll see if I can find some wire cutters, but I never get the chance. I've just unlocked my truck when I hear voices coming from behind the bar. There are two of them, and neither one sounds happy. Dropping my keys back in my pocket, I hurry that way, my feet crunching on pea gravel, but it feels as if I'm struggling through quicksand. I've just reached the side of the building when I hear McAllen say that he's given Danny a choice. Get the hell away from the bear or get carried out of here in the back of an ambulance. I hear Danny say, try it, asshole. I'm a lot tougher than that poor little bear. My pulse pounds and stutters in my throat, and I can't seem to breathe in the thick summer air. This is bad, I think, over and over. This is bad. For once in my life, I'm right. When I reach them, McAllen is reaching for something in his back pocket. A gun, maybe, and my legs nearly buckle with that thought. He's got a gun, and he's going to kill Danny. There's nothing I can do but watch my son die. McAllen, I shout, although I'm not sure what I can accomplish other than to end up on a slab next to Danny at the Harps County Morgue. McAllen glances in my direction. It's really just a flicker of his eyes, but that's all Danny needs. He crosses the gravel like a linebacker cutting off a running back, his shoulder lowered, the muscles in his legs pumping. McAllen's hand is still trapped in the pocket of his blue jeans when Danny slams into him, driving him against the bar's block wall hard enough to snap back his head. While McAllen is gasping for breath, Danny moves back a couple of inches, brings up his knee into the man's groin three times, then moves back like he's going to let him fall. That's the end of it, I think. That's the end of it, and it didn't turn out so bad. But Danny moves in again, drives his forearm into McAllen's throat, and then delivers a quick right to his solar plexus. He steps back to give McAllen room to fall. Let's get out of here, I say, but my voice is small and croaking, and Danny isn't listening anyway. Once he has McAllen on the ground, he kicks four, maybe five times in the ribs and stomach, and McAllen is gagging and gasping, whimpering a little. You're a big man, aren't you, Danny is shouting. What about it, tough guy? You think it's funny to treat a helpless animal like that? You think because it's small and loves you, you can do whatever you want? You think it's a joke? Who's laughing now, asshole? Tell me. But McAllen can't tell him anything because Danny ends every question by kicking him in the ribs, and foamy blood is bubbling at McAllen's lips. Somehow he's managed to free his hand from his pocket, but there's no gun or knife, just a thick white hand that flops helplessly on the gravel like a fish that's been yanked from deep water and left on rocks to die. I run to Danny, grab his arm. Enough, Danny, you're going to kill him. But he shoves me away and levels a finger in an accusation that I can't deny. Then he turns back to Ray McAllen and stomps his hand again and again until the hand is shattered and McAllen's wedding ring is buried deep in his bloody fingers. A horrible roar echoes in my head, and for a second I think it's coming from Danny, but I blink sweat from my eyes and see that Elmore has reared on his hind legs. The smell of blood or violence has riled him, and he has his head turned to the darkening sky, his mouth open, his teeth bared, and he no longer resembles a mangy dog or anything else but a bear. Danny, I say, Danny, please. I know it's useless. Things have gone so far that whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and nothing I say can change that. It's been too late for that for a long, long time. The best thing for me to do is walk back to my truck and leave Danny to whatever fate is going to find him. It seems like a petty, cowardly thought, but why should it? There's nothing I can do to help him now, nothing I can accomplish but get myself thrown into jail as an accessory. Before I can turn away, Danny kicks McAllen in the ribs again, and this time the older man's breath goes out in a whoosh and frothy blood runs from his mouth. He jerks a couple of times and then falls still. It doesn't take a doctor to know that he's dead. Maybe a rib punctured his heart, or maybe something else got him. That will be for the coroner to figure out, but it doesn't really matter. Dead is dead. Danny, I say. He stands over McAllen, panting, his thumbs hooked into the belt loops of his jeans. He had it coming. He got what he deserved. The words sound tough, but his voice is quivering, and when he looks at me, his bottom lip is trembling. He looks like a terrified but proud 5-year-old who is trying hard not to cry in the face of a spanking. Leave him, I think. I have to leave him. There's nothing else I can do. But I can't walk away from him. And that's so funny I have to stop myself from laughing aloud. The one time in my life when I can't do the easy thing and walk away is likely to get me locked in a state prison as an accessory to murder. Come on, son, I say. We need to get out of here. He's bending on his knee beside McAllen, as if he intends to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, or check to make sure the man is really dead. But when he stands up, he has something in his hand. My heart stutters a little, because I latch onto the idea that it's a gun, and my son means to kill me too, so he'll leave no witnesses. But I know that's ridiculous. Then I see that Danny's holding a key ring in his hand. We've gone 3, maybe 4 miles when the sirens begin to wail. My heart races and I'm drenched with sweat. Every time I glance into the rearview mirror and see Elmore chained to the roll bars, the wind whipping his fur, I flinch and yank the wheel. I want to run, pick up the West Kentucky Parkway in Greenview and head south. Mexico seems like the best option, but I know that's a daydream. How far can you get with maybe $400 between you and a stolen bear? Then, when the old brick buildings and glowing streetlights of Greenview are in sight, I turn right onto a gravel road and follow it for a half mile until it gives way into the old Sugar Creek mines. Danny's calmer now. He's rooted around under the seat until he found five loose cans of bush beer that had been rolling around since I went fishing last week, and now he's talking as if he didn't just leave a man lying dead on blood-stained gravel outside a roadhouse. He has a plan. We're going to release the bear out here so he can grow fat and healthy off a diet of wild hogs and white-tailed deer. The abandoned strip mines with their thousands of square acres of overgrown fields, pine thickets, sloughs, and coal pits will be paradise for a bear. But when I start to pull over, he tells me to go farther. He wants to find a just right place to release the bear. I could tell him that here by the road or deep in the mines won't make a difference. Tonight, maybe tomorrow, the bear will make its way back to the bar, because when you're lost and hungry and alone, you always return home. But I figure in the near future, neither one of us has a lot of good days coming, so I listen to the stories that my son wants to tell. You came through, he says. I wasn't sure, you know, but you did. I nod and leave it at that. There's no point in saying anything else. Danny's a dreamer, and tonight he's holding on to his illusions as hard as he can, but he isn't a fool. Besides, I like the fact that in his eyes, at least for the moment, I've made some sort of amends. When the hall road crests a hill that drops off to thickets and hollows, Danny says this is the place and jumps out of the cab before the truck is completely stopped. By the time I kill the ignition, Danny has scrambled into the truck bed and is unchaining the bear. Go, he tells it when they're back on the ground. Elmore grunts and sits on his haunches. Danny slaps his shoulder and tells him to run, and the bear lurches up, grunts again, takes a couple of steps, and turns its muzzle into the air, sniffing. Danny picks up a handful of gravel and pitches it at Elmore. Run, you son of a buck, he says. You're free. Don't you get it? Elmore whimpers and hangs back. Then Danny hits him with a clump of dirt, and suddenly Elmore seems to remember that he's a bear. He rears on his hind legs and growls, a deep rumbling growl that makes me shudder, and flashes his teeth at us before dropping to all fours and scrambling down the side of the hill into a pine thicket. Danny hands me one of the warm beers and raises his in a toast. Here's to Elmore, he says. I open the beer and drink with him, because how can you argue with an eternal optimist? A man certain that the next ticket he buys will win the lottery, and that he will find true love and divine guidance in a dive bar, and that each day holds a chance to start over, no matter what you did. This is my son, a murderer, a knight errant to lost girls, a rescuer of maltreated bears, a grown man who has almost forgiven his wayward father. The sirens have grown louder, and I know it's just a matter of time until they come for us. Most likely tonight, no later than in the morning. We must have passed a half dozen cars on our way out here, and who isn't likely to notice a truck that's carrying a wrestling bear? Soon the blue lights will find us, and whatever future is coming our way, we'll face it on our own. But for now, the only light comes from the moon bluing the pines, the only sound the chirpings of crickets, and Elmore's fading growls. For now, neither of us is alone.
The Last Wrestling Bear in West Kentucky is copyrighted by Tim L. Williams. Music for this podcast is by Sarah and Felix Perez-Hita and was obtained from the community audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.